Hi everyone, it's Helen here with a quick note before we get into the episode. The audio for this episode didn't record properly, which we didn't realise until after the fact, so I want to say a big thank you to Scott Barry, who was able to salvage the audio files. Without his tech know-how, this episode wouldn't be ready for publication, so thank you Scott so much. Now, on with the episode. Hello, you're listening to the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. We're your hosts, Helen McLean and Jan McIntosh Brown. Here, we aim to look at all aspects of brain injury, from the research to the rehabilitation, and always through the lens of speech and language therapy. Hi everyone, welcome to another episode. This is Helen.
And this is Jan.
Today we're going to focus on an approach to supporting people with brain injuries called social stories. I'm going to hold my hands up and say I'm not someone with detailed knowledge of this approach, but Jan, I know that you've used it fairly regularly, so I'm going to let you do most of the explaining. So could you start by giving some background as to where social stories came from?
Sure. So social stories is a trademarked approach that was developed by a school teacher called Carol Gray, and she worked with people with autism of all ages. And I first started using social stories when I also worked with children with disabilities within the school environment. And, you know, those did include children with autism as well. So I have been using social stories for all of my career. And when I came to working with people with brain injuries in inpatient rehab, I wondered if this would be an approach that would help people understand some of the things that was that perhaps they were struggling with. And I do feel that it has been quite helpful and quite useful. So yeah, I'm very happy to talk about it today, Helen.
Great. And I think, am I right in saying that a lot of this is based around social communication? Is that right?
Yeah, you're right. So it's not only for communication, it's a probably the word social would include routines and, you know, activities of daily living as well. Anything that the person is interacting with in their day-to-day life. So I do have an example, which we'll talk about later, that's not actually anything to do with communication as such in terms of talking and conversation, but more expectations of other people. I think social stories help people understand what is going to happen in particular situations and give some guidelines and support for behaviour, so you can increase the structure in a person's life and thereby reduce anxiety. It explains the rules and expectations. We can link in a person's values and their, you know, self-identity, and describe the outcomes of positive and negative behaviour. So really the aim of social stories is to increase someone's understanding of specific social situations and to make them more comfortable in those situations and possibly suggest appropriate responses in those situations.
So yeah, that sounds really interesting if we think in the context of brain injury, which you and I know can cause difficulties in using and understanding rules. And it is something that I think a lot of research shows that people with brain injuries do have that trouble. So if we think in a communication context about how long to maybe maintain eye contact with someone, how long to talk to someone, or how long to hold your side of the conversation, the difference between maybe being appropriately friendly or maybe overly familiar with someone. So it sounds straight away like social stories are a good way of explaining some of those things. What would you add to that aspect, Jan?
As you say, Helen, all those behaviours really are encompassed in communication, aren't they? I mean, how we interact with our environment, how we interact with people in our environment are through our communication and our behaviour. So a common goal that I, from talking with people with brain injuries, that they often, I think as all of us as human beings, is that we kind of want to fit in. We want to fit in with other people in our environments and our chosen communities, whether that be our family, our job, or going to the shops or out for a coffee. And all of those interactions have rules. So, you know, they have scripts. And for those interactions to work, it's almost like we need to cooperate with each other, you know. So when you interact with someone, you're interacting on the basis of a plan that is at least partially shared. We both kind of know what's meant to happen. And that plan, which I often refer to as a game, has rules. So, you know, it's like a game of Monopoly. If we all play by the rules, then we have a great game and we have fun and everybody wins, in a sense. Mm-hmm. If someone doesn't play by the rules, then kind of the game doesn't work and it's kind of a bit awkward and nobody wants to play. So most importantly, when people interact, we expect each other to follow the rules. When you walk into a shop to buy something, there's a social script. We both have an understanding, the shop assistant and me have an understanding of how that interaction will go. There's a game which will determine how I should act and how the sales assistant should act. And both of us will be comfortable and happy with the game if we both follow the script, follow the rules.
That's really interesting. And I think what comes to my mind when you're talking about that, that's in the context of brain injury, that we know sometimes people struggle with, is this idea of theory of mind. So the ability to attribute someone's mental state to ourselves, but also to others, and have an understanding that others have got beliefs, desires, intentions, perspectives that are different from ours. And so that links in with what you're saying about knowing that I have got a perspective on something and how I should act in a situation, going into a shop, for example. But the sales assistant also has a set of rules to follow and a set of perspectives that are going to be different from mine, but they have to dovetail together to make that interaction successful. But there's research showing that people with TBI have got a marked difficulty in that area of theory of mind. And then the knock-on impact is around areas of social functioning, because people maybe do struggle to pick up on someone else's internal states following a traumatic brain injury. They aren't following those rules that you were talking about, so they might come across as perhaps a little bit odd or a little bit egocentric or uninterested in what's going on around them. And I think you were telling me, Jana, even about someone who was described by family as even being a little bit creepy. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
So, yeah, Helen, I think what we often talk about, isn't it, that we often don't appreciate how much actually goes into communicating in situations. You know, it all kind of happens and we take it for granted. And social communication is definitely a big area, and social cognition. So much is inherent. We're you know, who says what the rules are? We learn those rules in our development and from being in those situations. They're not written down. There isn't a rule book that we can go back to and say, you didn't follow the rules. You know, we kind of, it's a negotiation that we work on together. And, you know, after a brain injury, that can sort of be quite challenging for people. So that can often result in, as the research shows us, breakdown in relationships, breakdown in the person's ability to fulfill their previous roles. So, you know, like we were talking about job, social, you know, sport, even going to the shops, and which would then have a massive impact on the person's well-being. The person is likely to experience anger and frustration and isolation, which are issues enough in themselves. However, it might lead to other issues such as substance abuse, neglect, or possible further brain injuries. So, you know, like I said, the rules aren't written down somewhere. And what we do as speech and language therapists is we work with people on social communication. And so social communication is how we use our language and behaviour in social settings to get on with others, to fit in. A social story is written with the intention of trying to make some of that implicit information explicit, and then through practice and repetition and success, that explicit information becomes implicit again. That's the goal, really, isn't it? So when you write a social story, it's to with the intention of giving that information and providing it and providing tuition on what people in a given situation are doing, thinking and feeling, and the sequence of events, the identification of those social cues and their meaning, and the script for what the person with the brain injury needs to do or say. In other words, the what, when, who and why aspects of social situations. So Carol Gray does describe what's involved in writing a social story. And should I say, there are very similar approaches in the field of brain injury, such as I think a term I've heard called, and you've mentioned, Helen, is social scripts by Mark Ilvesacker. I kind of lean more to social stories because I'm familiar with it and I like all the values-based stuff that I'm putting into them. So you can access information from Carol Gray's website, and she also has a book, and you can do training as well on how to write social stories. But maybe with our podcast today, it gives you enough of a flavour to go and have a go writing some social stories. Okay, so what you need to do is, when writing a social story, is to start with some short descriptions of the particular situation. So the event or activity, which includes the specific information about what to expect in that situation and why. I am going to give some examples so, you know, you'll be able to put this into context. We use literal and concrete language. There's no inferencing, there's no need to interpret, there's no implied meaning. It's all very concrete, step-by-step information to help the person understand the difficult or ambiguous situation or activity. We use supportive language, we use encouraging language to help build the person's self-image and self-esteem and capacity. We know after people have had brain injuries that they're going to be struggling with a lot of loss and grief and frustration. So we want to build their self-image and their you know, true ability in themselves, belief in themselves that they are capable and competent individuals. We want to be descriptive as well as coaching. So descriptive is factual information, and coaching statements are to help the person know what to do. So the other thing that I like about social stories are they are very individualized. You always start with the person. Start with a conversation with the person and then develop your story from there. I don't often call them social stories with the person. I've worked with people who of faith, and
we've often written them in terms of being prayers. I've worked with young people who are maybe, you know, previously done martial arts or go to gyms, and we've written things like codes of conduct, you know, or mantras if people are into meditation. And I wrote a social story for a man who'd, you know, been through university and had been a social worker, and he was very proud of his sons having gone to university. So he was quite familiar with the concept of a personal statement. So we wrote his social story in the context of a personal statement. So it's not, I don't say I'm going to write you a social story. I often just say I'm going to write down what we've talked about today. So an example of a social story that I wrote some years ago for a man who had had a hypoxic brain injury, and he really had a significant memory impairment, and this caused him to be quite anxious. He went home to live with his wife, and his wife was a school teacher and often came home in the evening with poor school teachers' work to do. So she had lessons to prep, she had homework from children to mark. So she would often be up late in the evening doing this, and she felt quite anxious because her husband would often be loitering downstairs, not quite knowing what to do while she was working. And she was trying to encourage him to go off to bed, and just because she knew that while he was in inpatient rehab, he was going to bed quite early, but now he was becoming quite fatigued because he felt that he had to wait up for her. So it was just a very brief conversation that I had with his wife. And then I said, look, I'm going to give you something and see if it will work. So we wrote this social story together. So here it goes. When I feel tired, I will go upstairs and go to bed. Mary still has work to do, so she will come up later. I will be able to hear her pottering around downstairs. If I feel sleepy, I will go to sleep. Mary will come to bed when she's ready. So the advice that I gave to his wife was to, it's always written in first person because we want the person with the brain injury to internalize the message and it become like a self-talk. You know, I don't know if you've ever been had an exam and you're feeling really nervous, whether it's driving or a, you know, a university exam, you're feeling really nervous and you say, I'm going to be okay, I'm going to be okay, I'm going to be okay. So you don't say, you know, you don't talk to yourself in second or third person, you talk to yourself in first person. So what I want, and the goal of social stories, is it becomes an internalized message. I will be okay. So I suggested to his wife that I tend to read them in first person when I'm with the person. And so I suggested to his wife that on the way home, that she read the story to him in first person. So, and he was able to read. So then she read it driving home. She then gave him a copy for him to look at. And then around 9 p.m. at night, she read it again with him, sitting next to him on the couch. And then the next day she fed back to me that he went to bed on his own that night and continued to do so from there on until he was discharged. And I don't know if he's still going to bed on his own, but you know, it was a very quick, easy 2-minute thing to do and to give it a go, and it was successful for them. I'm not saying it's always going to be successful, but it was successful for them. So another example, and I'll maybe just do this one in terms of the prayer as an example, was from a man who had a brain injury some years ago, 20 years ago, but he didn't have any rehab. And he was living with his wife in a rural situation, and he was having some sexualized behaviors. He didn't intend any sexualized behaviors. However, other people were interpreting them as sexualized behaviors, and he was a person of faith. So the story that we wrote together, this man and I wrote this together, is, and here we go. Dear Lord, thank you for helping me to be a good citizen. Strengthen me so that I am respectful towards all people. Dear Lord, I get confused over who is a friend and who is an acquaintance. Help me to remember that friends are people who I spend time with socially. I see them regularly and we have shared interests. Acquaintances are people who I might see when they are helping me, such as a doctor or someone working for me. I keep them at arm's length. Help me to understand the differences. When I get confused, I will remember to ask Jane. So Jane was his wife, and this situation was quite tragic because he was actually getting into quite serious difficulties with the people he had coming working on his property. So, you know, he responded so well to this story and to the prayer, and his wife responded so well to it as well, and they were able to go home and live. He has now passed away, not just from old age related illness, but they were able to return to their home and live in peace to the end of his life. So, you know, I feel that this helped him understand how to interact with different people that he might come across in his day.
Jan, I think those couple of examples are just so interesting to hear, that I'll be honest, they're the sorts of things, yes, I've done scripts with people, but they're your social story examples, they are different from what I've done, but I love how personalised they are. But I think what really comes through for me is the impact that those changes to those individuals' communication, how the impact that had on their day-to-day relationships, which I think is something that can get lost a little bit. We think about how someone is going to manage getting back to work or the physical aspects of day-to-day life, but actually it sounds in both of those cases it was the interactions with their spouse and with the people that were directly around them and the relationships that they had with them. They were the things that they were actually struggling the most with. But not to underplay what you've done there, but actually it's something that sounds like most of us would be able to access as communication specialists, as speech and language therapists. We could do that with someone, couldn't we?
I didn't have any, back in the days when I started working and using social stories, I didn't have any specific training. It's now trademarked and there is training, but back in the days it was, here you go, here's a case, fix this, you know. So yeah, you just kind of learn from doing. And again, Helen, this was an approach that was created by a teacher, and we took it on as speech and language therapists and occupational therapists and psychologists. You know, we were all doing them, you know, so it's not specific to speech and language therapy. I think the unique thing that we bring is that understanding of how communication is so inherent to all of those things, and that ability to sort of simplify things out and just make it really clear how a person can interact better with others.
And I think what's also really interesting is you saying that it comes from very much a place of identifying that individual's kind of values and what is particularly important to them, and starting from that. Could you explain a little bit more about kind of what's actually involved and kind of getting down to the details around structuring it, arriving at how you build a social story?
Sure. So there has to be a need. So there's a need identified, and from there, I think it's fairly well accepted. We start a conversation with the person. So the conversation is, we need to be a little bit brave. We need to sort of, you know, be open and ready to give some feedback. I often start with what's important to the person. So, you know, the person that I'm going to talk about, Brad, he was identified by his family, and he used this himself, as being creepy. What was important to him was getting, being normal, whatever that might mean, but being normal. And so what did that mean to him? So just kind of trying to pick apart what does that person want? What is it that that their goal is? Why are they in rehab? What has changed since their brain injury? What are their values and their qualities? I often say to people, because they are dealing with a lot of grief and loss, that often deep down inside of us, our values are still constant. So, you know, those values of caring and humour and honesty and loyalty, those things are often still within us. And sometimes, because of the chaos of a brain injury, that can often be masked for a while. And a social story can take a while to write. It can be very quick, like I've explained previously, but you shouldn't expect to just write a perfect one right away. You might need to redraft it and rewrite it. And I always bring it back to the person and say, have a read of that. How does that feel to you? Does that feel like you? Does that feel like something that you're wanting to achieve? And then trying to think, like I was saying before, what would be contextual for that person? Would it be a mantra? Would it be a personal statement? Would it be a letter? Sometimes if I don't have anything, I will just say, I'm going to write a letter about what we talked about today. And so that is often the start, and you're unpicking constantly, trying to refine it and make it more meaningful. Back in the days, I don't know if this was ever written, we did, when we introduced these with children, we often said that, you know, it needed to create a habit, to create that self-talk, that deeper understanding of what the social story contained. The person needed to read it every day for a period of time. So I would encourage for you to ask the person to read it every day, stick it up on their wall. I will often put it on a person's wall in their bedroom and just pop in every day, 30 seconds. Mm. Oh, let's have a read of this together. How does that feel? Do you feel that happening for you? Do you, you know, and get their feedback on it. The next thing is the communication goal is, and obviously the big communication goal is for all of us to interact and to be able to receive and send messages to others. So your goal is to send a message that can be fully understood by the person receiving it. If my words say one thing and my body says another, then my message is not really that clear. I also want people to like being with me. I often use that. I feel comfortable with you. I feel uncomfortable. I always use feel in my statements. And people want to be respected and not feel scared or freaked out. So when people feel comfortable with me, they'll like being with me. So often, you know, you hear, I don't care what people think about me, but often people do actually, and you need to sort of help them see that, yeah, but if you go into a shop and just get something from the shopkeeper, you actually want the shopkeeper to be with you and interact with you, otherwise you're not going to achieve your goal. So in motivational interviewing, they talk about creating dissonance between, you know, a person's personal values and beliefs and qualities and a behaviour. So through discussion, you know, the person will identify their key motivator. So what is it that the person wants to achieve to motivate them to use appropriate behaviour? So I want people to feel comfortable with me. I want to fit in. I want to be normal. Okay, so that's what I want. I want people, that's my goal, that's why I would make some changes. So how do I do that? Well, I use professional behaviours perhaps, I use respectful behaviours, I use behaviours that people will find easy to be around. And so you support the person, chat about what those behaviours might look like. I'll use eye contact, I'll keep personal comments to myself. Whatever the target behaviour is, you then describe what you're asking the person to achieve.
And is it fair to say that with this process, what you're aiming to do is, it's not just about building a script, it's about building a person's self-esteem and building their self-identity?
Yeah. We want to build a person's self-esteem and self-identity because that then challenges the behaviours that we're targeting and hopefully will support them occur less. It's not to say that a person won't become angry. I mean, anger and frustration, they're normal human emotions and they're important for us to feel. However, when those difficulties occur, when those emotions occur, they won't overwhelm the person. They'll have some strategies to deal with them and how to behave with others and communicate so that they can continue to be the person that they choose to be, that person that's easy to be around, that person that's professional, that person's the loving father, the caring husband, that person. So the way that we write social stories provides positive feedback for a person as the social story describes a person by their values and talks about their goals and motivators. And that's the ultimate goal of a social story, is that it becomes positive self-talk for the person, like a positive affirmation. And the repetitive nature of a social story and the way you introduce it, I often find also introduces a language of social communication for both the person and the brain injury. So it makes it easier to provide feedback to the person. Oh, I like your eye contact. It shows me you're listening. It helps me feel comfortable with you. So that makes feedback and interactions more effective.
That's interesting. So if you use social stories quite early, perhaps with some people, and then that's helped to kind of build onto kind of goals in the further rehab tasks?
Yeah. So I think, you know, sometimes I think what we do is just a little bit odd, you know. And so introducing some of the concepts in through a social story helps people become more familiar with it. You know, I'm working with someone at the moment with eye contact, and it's probably he really doesn't have good eye contact at all. But it's almost like a new concept that someone's trying to explain to him. And I'm trying to say, well, it shows me that you're listening. It shows me that you're interested. He's not convinced yet. But, you know, through repetition of that, it helps him understand why eye contact is so important. So shall I talk about Brad?
Yes, absolutely. I think that would be really helpful to hear in more detail. Yeah.
Well, it'll put a bit of structure on some of the things that I've talked about, and then we'll probably finish after that, Helen. Yeah.
Okay.
So, a bit of background. Brad was in his late 30s when he came to us. He had his brain injury when he was 18, and he'd been living at home with his family since then. There were reported issues with him being overly familiar with people, particularly females that he worked with. So he did some voluntary jobs like in charity shops and things. He was very able, you know, one of our people who talk better than they think. So he came to our inpatient rehab in 2012. During his assessment with us, he demonstrated behaviours that were very much likely to put him at risk in the community. He touched females. Now, not necessarily in private places. He would touch their knees or their shoulders or their hands. In our setting, we are quite strict. We need to be strict. We need to set clear boundaries so there is no touching. So that became really difficult for him because he couldn't understand why we were asking him not to touch females, or, I mean, males is not so bad. He also stared at them and he said that he wasn't aware that he was staring, and he asked for personal information. So, you know, are you married? Do you have a boyfriend? What age are you? And unfortunately, there were also instances of him exposing himself. So standing naked in front of his window and things. So these were really serious concerns. So what I did was we started talking about the rules of communication in relation to different types of relationships. So you may or may not have heard of, and again, this comes from my background in working with children with disabilities. And in Australia, we called them social circles. So it's really just a relationship map where you sort of map out people in the person's life. So family, friends, acquaintances, professionals and strangers. And then I use it to map on communication behaviours and pragmatics. So, you know, what sort of rules do we use within each relationship? And not so much to my surprise, Brad knew all the answers. So he had obviously had therapy before and he knew it all. However, he had difficulty agreeing with the need for the rules. He would say, I'm just a friendly guy, always have been, and it's the rest of the world who has a problem. And especially me, his speech therapist. So as I've spoken to before, his motivator was for him to be normal. And so I reframed that, because what is normal, and it's a slightly negative way to think about it. I reframed that to him fitting in. So his ultimate life goal is to live on his own independently and be in a relationship. So at the moment, his behaviours were putting him, that was not possible for him at that point in time. So we needed for him to be safe in the community. We needed him to use appropriate social communication behaviours. And this was presented to him in a way to help him achieve his goal. So in his words, by being less friendly, he would fit in and be safe, which would help him move on and live independently in the community. So I'd just come back from Sheila McDonald's Cognitive Communication Disorders course, and she had talked about trying to encourage people to coach themselves. So Brad was quite, he had a smartphone and he was quite into his technology. So I had him, so we were having all these conversations, so I had him summarise what he felt we were talking about, and what behaviours he felt he could adopt to help him fit in, and then had him record a video on his phone. And this is the video, this is the script that he wrote for his video. It's not my words, it's his words. And so let me read it out to you. Hello me, it's me. I'm working on becoming less vulnerable, well, less friendly with people I meet in the community, in order to make myself less vulnerable. I need to practice smiling less, not getting into conversations, not telling jokes. And I need to practice this all the time, so I remember it and it becomes second nature. So the triggers for his stepping over people's boundaries was that he interpreted if a shop assistant was friendly towards him, he thought that that was then occasion for him to be even more friendly and staring and asking personal questions. He had great difficulty understanding that shopkeepers were paid to be friendly. He was quite offended by that concept. And so I needed to take him, I would take him out three times a week to the local cafe. I would ask him to, he would watch his video, we would talk about it on the way over, we would talk about the behaviours. I would ask him to focus on me when we were in the shop and to almost ignore the shop assistant. And then if we got to the table and all was good, it was like, high five, well done, great work, I felt really comfortable with you. So after some time doing this, we then graduated to his more fuller social story, and I'll read this to you now. I want to be like everyone else, safe and independent in the community. I need to remember not to get too excited and over-enthusiastic. In shops, I need to remember staff are paid to be friendly. They are strangers. At work, other staff need to be friendly with each other and me, their acquaintances. When people are at work, I should just leave them alone. I need to stay clear of jokes and sarcasm, as these can be misinterpreted. I need to keep myself to myself, keep my eyes in my head. I need to avoid touching others. When I feel annoyed, I'll tell the person I'm annoyed and walk away, staying calm, mature, and well-balanced. Doing these things will help me be independent and safe in the community so that I can be like everyone else. I'm glad to say that Brad hasn't quite moved into the community, but he does spend a lot more time at home now. He is in more of a supported accommodation, but the clinical team that's supporting him now are keen to see him move to independent living. There are hardly any episodes of either aggressive or sexualized behavior, so he's internalized this really well, and I'm really proud of him.
Fantastic, Jan. And can I just check, so the time scale between that first script and then that second one, do you remember roughly how long that took?
It probably took, because when we were seeing each other sort of three times a week, it was quite intensive, and then we dropped off. So that was probably a 12-week period of the intensive. And then when he started going out onto community placements, so maybe 6 months. Mm-hmm. But there was a period of no contact.
Mm-hmm. I just think it's sometimes helpful for people who maybe aren't as experienced in working with the brain injury population, and also maybe for people, you know, deciding how much input someone gets, to think about actually that we're in this for the long run, aren't we, with people.
That chronic condition that, you know, Lynn Gresson has talked to us about,
So all of these changes are taking quite a bit of time, aren't they? And I suppose for as clinicians, to say that, like, you know, the changes will be slow and steady, and if you're not seeing big changes happen within the space of a few weeks, I would say that's not because you're not doing a good job. That's because actually you're working with something that's very complex. Because I think that sometimes I've had other clinicians say to me who maybe haven't had as much experience in brain injury, say, am I doing the right things because I'm not sure I'm seeing progress here? Is there something else I should be doing? And actually they are doing a good job. It is just the nature of brain injury. Something massive has happened to this person. And as we've spoken about with the cognitive communication competence model, there's lots of factors at play here. It's not just about someone's language skills,
We're looking at the emotions, at the cognition, at the physical aspects. There's so many things interacting that makes all of this difficult. But that's been really interesting to hear about.
Yeah. And I must say, Helen, that even when I wasn't having intensive interactions with Brad, he was still in the environment of rehab, and he wasn't with us for such a long period because he necessarily needed it. It was just because there wasn't somewhere for him to move to. And so he kind of got stuck a little bit, you know, but that was great. I think that was great for Brad because we were able to provide more continuous, you know, longer term support for him, which has, I think, produced really good outcomes for him, mm-hmm. you know. So I think, yeah, this chronic nature of brain injury. I mean, if you think about Brad, he had his injury at 18. He came to us in his 30s.
Mm-hmm. And it goes to show there's always scope for change and for improvement, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it sounds like he was really willing and motivated, even if he didn't necessarily always agree with the feedback you were giving him.
Yeah, I think when we changed it from this is me telling you to you mm-hmm. telling you,
mm-hmm.
it really worked for him. And also putting it into what is it that you want? Let me help you get what you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's very values-based then,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that's probably nicely in keeping with, I think, a general shift in rehabilitation in recent years, that we do tend to look at it more in a person-centred, values-based
yeah.
approach rather than, well, I'm the therapist, you're yeah. the patient, this is what I think you should do, which is, I think it sounds from what you're saying about social stories, it's something that, even probably in other aspects, not just brain injury, but I bet for some people, for example, with progressive conditions or stroke, mm-hmm. potentially could use. But I think it's certainly something that I want to go away and learn more about. So I think you've mentioned that there's maybe some resources that we can put into the show notes that will provide listeners with some links to. But yeah, I think that's a great introduction to social stories. So thanks so much, Jan, for putting all that information together. That was really helpful. But that's, I think, all for us for the moment. So we'll be back soon with another episode. But for now, we'll say bye.
Bye for now.
The opinions and views expressed in this podcast are of the individual and should not be considered professional advice. If you have a brain injury, suspect you have a brain injury, or think someone you know has a brain injury, please seek dedicated professional advice.